Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Good morning, I'm Roland Martin. Next on News What Now, what the hell do you have to lose? That's what Donald Trump is saying to African Americans as he makes some strange comments before a nearly all-white audience in Michigan. We'll talk to surrogates from the Clinton and Trump campaign, plus our panel as well. George orders the parents of Kendrick Johnson, the Georgia teen mysteriously found dead, to pay the attorney's fees of the folks they sued. We will talk to Kendrick's parents right here in the simulcast on TV One, as well as the Tom Joyner Morning Show. Also, George Curry, noted journalist. He has covered many folks over the years. He died on Saturday. He was a good friend of mine. We'll pay tribute to him, talking to Pulitzer Prize winning columnist Clarence Page, Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr., Ed Gordon, Hazel Trice Etney, Law Victoria Burke, Spencer Overton, and others. All of that right here. News One Now starts right now.
Has been more harmed by Hillary Clinton's policies than African Americans. No group. If Hillary Clinton's goal was to inflict pain on the African American community, she could not have done a better job. It's a disgrace.
Folks, that is Donald Trump speaking at a rally on Friday in Michigan, where he is making an attempt to court black voters. Well, you heard that is his attempt to do so. Well, it's interesting that he was speaking in a town that is 93% white. Earlier in the week, he also spoke in Wisconsin, in a town 95% white. What in the world is going on with Donald Trump's strategy to court black voters when you look at many states like Ohio and Pennsylvania? He's polling literally at 0%. Here's more of Donald Trump's attempt to woo black voters.
Look how much African-American communities have suffered under Democratic control. To those I say the following. What do you have to lose by trying something new like Trump? What do you have to lose? You're living in poverty. Your schools are no good. You have no jobs. 58% of your youth is unemployed. What the hell do you have to lose? Hillary Clinton would rather provide a job to a refugee from overseas than to give that job to unemployed African-American youth in cities like Detroit who have become refugees in their own country. And at the end of 4 years, I guarantee you that I will get over 95% of the African-American vote, I promise you. Because I will produce for the inner cities, and I will produce for the African Americans.
95%? Okay, that's quite interesting, Donald Trump. Folks, on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos, Kellyanne Conway, Trump's new campaign manager, she says she thought his outreach to black folks was great.
But many in the African American community saw that as insulting, as they say most African Americans don't live in poverty, and that Mr. Trump was making those comments in communities that are more than 90% white.
But those comments are for all Americans, and I live in a white community. I'm white. I was very moved by his comment. In other words, he is trying to tell Americans that we can do better. And the thing that he said that I think got a great deal of resonance is that maybe Hillary Clinton looks at you as voters this year, takes you for granted. I look at you as people. And if you, again, George, if you think 58% of unemployment in the African American youth community is a good idea, then absolutely please go vote for Hillary Clinton, everyone. But he's saying you can't do any worse. We're the party. He's the candidate that believes in school choice vouchers and charter schools for African-American Hispanic students and everybody really, but they've benefited. I've done a lot of work in that space here in New York City, and it's just remarkable to see the quality education that these students who are fully capable and very intelligent receive through school choice and charters. Hillary Clinton's against those.
All right, folks, let's do a little fact check here. Donald Trump says 58% of black youth are unemployed, but the reality is this, he's counting black kids who are high school students and college students who are in classes. Also, he lays this out, his poverty claim, where basically all of black folks are in poverty. No, 26% of African Americans, about 10 million African Americans, live in poverty. There are 45 million African Americans in the United States. That's Trump's facts. Let's go right to a couple of folks. Let's talk about this here. First up, James Davis, a board member for the National Diversity Coalition for Trump. He joins us from a pastor from Cleveland, Ohio. Joins us via Skype. Also from New York, Jelena Maxwell, the progressive media director for Hillary Clinton. James, Pastor Davis, I want to go to you first. Are you there?
I'm here, sir. Good morning.
Okay, I need you to explain to me. Donald Trump's facts are wrong. The numbers he's presenting are dead wrong. But people, African Americans all across social media, felt insulted by his comments. How is speaking to a 93% white audience, 95% early in the week, somehow a real outreach to black folks?
Well, I don't care if he's in Iowa or in one of the small, you know, in a town that has a 0%. Black population. At the end of the day, when he opens his mouth, the entire world listens and the cameras are going to be there. So obviously black people heard the message because we're on here talking about it this morning. When Hillary Clinton went to Scranton, Pennsylvania a couple of weeks ago, no one had a problem with her being in a town that scarcely has black people. And she was addressing similar issues herself. So the venue, I think we can kind of dismiss that because it doesn't matter where he is.
Well, actually, Pastor Davis, we can't dismiss that because when he was earlier the week in Wisconsin, he didn't speak in Milwaukee. Also, there he was. He didn't speak in Detroit. And so he didn't speak to the NAACP, didn't speak to the National Urban League, did not speak to the National Association of Black Journalists. So at what point is Donald Trump actually going to talk to black people who are actually in the room?
I think that was already attempted. Because when you went to Chicago, the minions took over and shut the meeting down and bragged about
no,
the
actually,
meeting.
No, that's not true.
It is Pastor Davis.
Pastor Davis. First and foremost, Pastor Davis.
Then all of a sudden, now he's supposed to go back into hostile territory.
No, Pastor Davis.
It's probably better that he speaks away from it than sitting in the middle of it.
Pastor Davis, wait a minute. When he had a rally in Chicago, that wasn't speaking to black folks. It was at the University of Chicago, Illinois campus. That wasn't at Chicago State. I'm going to ask you again. No, one second.
Speaking to whether or not there was a majority of people in these areas. And so now he goes into a city that has a huge minority block in it. And then all of a sudden it turns into chaos. And then, Pastor Davis. I guess he's supposed to go into the line of fire every
Pastor
time.
Davis.
And so the venue question
Pastor
is
Davis.
Silly. At the end of the day, regardless
Pastor
of
Davis.
Venue, this, go ahead, Roland.
I'm going to ask you a simple question. I want a simple answer. Why is it that Donald Trump would not speak in front of largely African-American audiences?
Again, if I'm going into a place that is hostile, then why should I come if I'm going to be rejected? If your mind is already made up, because it seems to me that black America's mind is already made up about Mr. Trump, most of them. And so now I'm going to speak to you from afar and say, because if he can speak to a couple of folks and wake up just a handful, because even some of the smart folks in black intelligentsia are saying that if he pulls three, some of these pundits are going to say if he pulls 3 out of 20, he has the election. And there are people that are waking up. There's a wave of people that are saying, we're tired of people
going
on our head and telling us that it's raining. They've had enough of it.
I want to go to Zerlina Maxwell. Zerlina, it's interesting because President George W. Bush spoke 5 out of 8 years as president to the National Urban League. He spoke to the National Urban League when he was running for president. And so I don't think anybody has called the National Urban League a hostile audience. Mitt Romney in 2012, right. He spoke to the NAACP. That wasn't hostile. I was actually there. Also, numerous candidates over the years, including Senator Bob Dole, has spoken to the National Association of Black Journalists. I was there. And so those are not hostile audiences. Your take on Trump's refusal to actually speak in front of African Americans?
Well, I think there's a reason why he's refusing to speak in front of African-American audiences. And there's a reason why African-American audiences are at this point hostile to what he is saying. He spent a large portion of the 8 years of the Obama presidency asking for the first black president's birth certificate. He, remember, was leading that charge to get President Obama to release his, quote, long-form birth certificate. He came out the day one of his presidential campaign insulting Mexicans, calling them rapists. His entire campaign has been demeaning rhetoric and divisive policies. So there is a reason why black people don't support him. It's not that we're just hostile to an alternative message. It's the fact that his rhetoric is divisive and demeaning. And we're rejecting that. I think also, if he had something to offer black people, it's not that we don't have anything to lose. We have everything to lose, and he has nothing to offer us.
I got to ask you this question here. I'm going to ask both of you this question. Now, I'll ask you, Zelina, first. If I decided to put together, let's say, a town hall that speaks specifically to black issues, do you believe that your candidate, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, would participate in that kind of event in front of African Americans?
Well, of course, Roland, because as you know, she already has participated in 2 town halls with you. And she's also, as you said, gone to the Urban League, gone to the NAACP, and most recently gone to NABJ. So she is not shying away from speaking directly to African Americans, but it's not just about talking to those communities. She's also listening to the mothers of the movement. She's listening to young African American people and trying to tackle and provide solutions for the issues that they are bringing to light. And that will continue all the way through Election Day and then beyond that, because she's actually saying, hold me accountable for what I'm promising to do, and I want to actually provide solutions to make your lives better. I think that that's something that we can actually believe in. If you don't have anything to offer, of course you're going to say, oh, you have nothing to lose, because you're not providing any solutions.
Pastor Davis, if I chose to set up a town hall, let's say in Chicago, let's say in Baltimore, and we aired it on TV1, would Donald Trump show up to that kind of town hall in front of African Americans? And should he show up?
And that he absolutely should, and I believe that he would. Circling back to the original comment.
Are you giving your word that you believe that if we put this together, that Donald Trump would actually show up to discuss black issues in front of black people?
Why wouldn't he? Again, the hostility has become based upon this media portrayal of him being the so-called rhetoric of all of this. The whole birther issue, circling back to that, that appeared in the public discourse somewhere in 2008 from the Hillary Clinton camp. And as much as liberal media wants to deny that, he picked it up in 11, and I agree with that. He picked it up in 11 and drove the point
home. Was it wrong for him to do it? Was it Pastor Davis?
What he has to say.
Now, Pastor Davis, was it wrong? No. I got to ask you.
It's the same courtesy and respect.
I got to ask you this here. Was it wrong?
Got the long form birth certificate, and so black people have this offense, so they can't even hear the message because they're offended that the least vetted president in history got called out on whether or not he was a citizen or not. Get past that.
So what do we have right now?
And so he's saying, what the hell do we have to lose? At the end of the day, we have a higher poverty rate, higher unemployment. Our cities are melting around us. We have police brutality, all the rest of these things that are going on in our communities. Our community is on fire and no one is sending a fire truck. And so the man is simply saying, try something new, because all I hear out of the Hillary camp is the same old saying, what we've always gotten. And so here we sit right now.
Well, I'll tell you what, so Pastor Davis, I got 20 seconds. So you saying you were supportive of Donald Trump's attacks on President Obama and his birth certificate?
I'm saying that the president needed to be vetted, yes.
He was, but he's an American. So why question his American credentials?
because it was unclear. And if something's unclear, no, it needs to be vetted. Okay. I don't care who it is. See, that's the sensitivity. Okay. That we have, that if you ask a black man a question, or if you call the black folks into accountability, because if the previous chair of the Congressional Black Caucus said, if we were in the economic condition that we're in underneath a white administration, that we would be burning the White House down. But I'm racist if we call them into accountability and I'm white, and I'm a Tom or a coon if I call them into accountability and I'm black. So which is accountability at all.
I don't use those phrases, but I'll say this here. A lot of black folks clearly offended by the birther issue. We certainly appreciate it. Thank you so very much. Thank you very much, Jelena Maxwell, Pastor Davis. When we come back, we'll talk to the parents of Kendrick Johnson. They are being ordered to pay the legal fees of folks who they sued. That's a problem for a lot of folks. We'll hear directly from them when we come back. News 1 Now on TV One.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
He's already been served. I served him. He's taken care of. He's a little slow, but he got it.
Roland Martin, brought to you by Bahamas Tourism. Bahamas Air has special fares on flights from Orlando starting at $232 beginning September 8th. Visit BahamasAir.com or call 1-800-222-4262. This morning from Chicago, Roland Martin, good morning.
Tom, Sybil J, good morning. I'm at WYCC here in Chicago. I'm hosting a race panel with Google later today, so that's why I'm here. And Tom, major condolences to my dear friend, George Curry, and his family. Of course, the journalist died Saturday at the age of 69. We're paying tribute to him right here on TV One and later today. And so just a tremendous journalist and a huge loss for so many of us. Tom, Kendrick Johnson. We've covered this story. Young black man, January 11th, 2013. His body was found in a rolled up mat. Autopsy was done. They say accidental death. There were bruises on his body. The family has been demanding answers. The family then filed various lawsuits against different people. Now, all of a sudden, Tom, a judge has ruled that that family must pay the legal fees of individuals who they sued. Joining us right now, Mr. and Mrs. Kendrick Johnson. Folks, good morning. Welcome to the Tom Joyner Morning Show on TV One. How are you?
Good morning.
Your reaction to the judge's decision last week that you must pay the legal fees of individuals who you sued and then later dropped those lawsuits?
It's just another slap in the face. It's like, we're having to pay for my son being murdered.
First of all, how many lawsuits were filed? And you dropped those lawsuits. They're saying you have to now pay those legal fees. So how many suits are we talking about? And have they calculated how much money the judge is ordering you to repay?
It's been a couple of lawsuits. And so far, we've heard $900,000 back pay.
$900,000?
Yes.
Why did you drop the lawsuit?
Well, it was in a situation where they were trying to push the civil suit before the criminal suit was taking place. So we decided to drop it, too, in order to pick it back up within those 6 months.
Now, when you say drop it, so here's what happened here. The U.S. Attorney's Office took over the investigation from Valdosta, Georgia, from the officials there. The U.S. Attorney's Office eventually concluded that they were not going to file charges against anyone. That was the criminal part. The wrongful death lawsuits that you and your lawyers filed, that was on the civil side. So are you saying those civil lawsuits were dropped?
Yes. Civil lawsuits would drop.
Is it your plan to refile those lawsuits?
Yes, they will be refiled.
So what's then going to happen to these attorney's fees? Could you and your family potentially be on the hook for even more attorney's fees if you proceed forward with these lawsuits?
I'm not sure at this point, but maybe we could, but we are going to proceed forward. We're not going to be distracted by what they're trying to do to make us be silent. We will not let them silence us about our son's murder. Nothing they can do.
How do they explain the murder of your son? Why was he in that mat?
Well, they keep saying it was an accident. He fell into the mat. They got stuck and died. But me being his mom, I know that my son wouldn't even try to crawl into no mat. And then the Justice Department even came out and told us in the meeting what we had with them that KJ's shoe was placed under his head, the shoe that he was supposedly reaching for.
Tom, also, we were talking about a young man who was an athlete, very fit, and the logic, and this is, Mrs. Johnson, I'm trying to understand, the logic that there was a shoe in a mat, he simply had the strength to just push over the mat to get the shoe.
Yeah, unroll the mat.
As opposed to crawl down in a mat.
Right.
Makes no sense.
But it makes sense to somebody, and those somebodies are the ones that are in charge of making these decisions.
Yeah.
Mrs. Johnson, do you believe that these slapping you with these legal fees is an attempt to get you and your husband and your attorneys to stop pursuing justice in this case?
Yes, it is.
Do you all have a legal fund?
Yes, we're setting up one. We have a GoFundMe that's set up. Someone has just set up for us to try to raise those legal fees.
Okay. This is certainly a stunning case, Tom. And again, we know from other states that the threat of having to pay the legal fees of anyone you sue is keeping other people from pursuing justice in similar cases. And that seems to be exactly what's going on right here.
Yes, but I mean, as I say again, there's nothing they can do to stop us from pursuing this case. We're going to take this case all the way through. No matter how many distractions they throw at us or whatever they try to throw at us, we're going to keep pushing. We're going to find out exactly what happened to Kendrick Johnson, who killed Kendrick Johnson.
Roland, as we leave, could you recap what happened to Kendrick Johnson?
January 11th, 2013, Kendrick Johnson was in a gymnasium at Lowndes High School in Valdosta, Georgia, when they say that somehow his tennis shoe fell down a rolled-up mat, a large rolled-up mat, and they claim that Kendrick then climbed on top of the mat, crawled down into the mat to get his shoe. He got stuck, and therefore he suffocated. Autopsy was done. There was bruising on his body. It was ruled accidental, but then the county sheriff's office and the school were not necessarily trying to work with the family. What ended up happening, Tom, in this particular case, there was a missing piece of the video. All of a sudden, there are cameras all around the school. It captured Kendrick right before the mat incident, but somehow the video of him in the gymnasium crawling into the mat is no longer there. And the attorneys were jamming them up saying, what's going on with the missing video? And so that's also one of the huge questions in this case as well.
Were there anybody else in the gym?
Yes, there were other students in the gym, and those individuals have been investigated, including the sons of an FBI agent.
And isn't one of the boys also connected to the sheriff?
Yes, as well. All of that was investigated by the U.S. Attorney's Office. They concluded that they could not ascertain, and they said that no one was involved, no charges were filed, and they have gone with the accidental death of Kendrick Johnson.
And the hearing regarding the fees has been canceled, and so we don't know if there's going to be a rescheduling or where this goes from here.
Right. So we'll be following this to see what happens next.
And there is a GoFundMe page, correct?
Yeah. So what we'll do is we'll get those details, Mrs. Johnson, provide them on blackamericaweb.com and news1.com.
All right.
All right, Roland.
Mrs. Johnson, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
That's so sad. Wow. Huggy next, 25 past.
All right, folks, when we come back on TV One, we'll celebrate the life and legacy of journalist George Curry, a pioneer, somebody who was committed to the black press. We'll talk to folks who knew him best, who worked with him, all of that. News One Now on TV One.
Congressman G.K. Butterfield, you have one vote. Use it.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Folks, welcome back to News One Now. On Saturday, we lost a true legend in our industry. George Edward Curry, a longtime journalist, died of a heart attack at his home in Maryland at the age of 69. Many folks know George most primarily as the editor-in-chief of the award-winning Emerge magazine. Of course, a black monthly magazine that set the standard for lots of different other magazines. Many people remember the covers of Clarence Thomas, Kimba Smith, and so many others. But Curry also was a friend of this show, appearing on News One Now, as well as my previous Sunday show, Washington Watch. He was a native of Tuscaloosa, Alabama. He was the second African-American ever hired at Sports Illustrated, then moved on to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and then went to the Chicago Tribune, where he covered the presidential campaign of the Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr. while serving as a Washington correspondent. After that, he became the New York bureau chief for the Tribune, and then chose to go to Emerge magazine. In 2003, he was honored as the Journalist of the Year by the National Association of Black Journalists. He then went on to work for the National Newspaper Publishers Association, known as the Black Press, running their newswire, also writing his weekly column, appearing in more than 100 newspapers nationwide. George covered anything and everything, and we're going to pay tribute to him right now. Joining us in studio, and our panel is Hazel Trice Etney. She's the editor and publisher of the Trice Etney Newswire. She worked alongside George there at the NNPA. Also, we have Spencer Overton, president of the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, as well as Lawn Victoria Burke, a writer for NBC Black. Also joining us is Clarence Page, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Chicago Tribune, as well as Kimba Smith, a young woman whose story George chronicled in Emerge magazine, who was in prison for decades for her involvement in a drug case. She was later, of course, released from federal prison. But I want to go to Hazel first. Hazel, you worked alongside George. Certainly, it was a shock to those of us who knew him well of his passing on Saturday.
Absolutely. Denise Rolock Barnes called me because it was such a big rumor on Saturday evening, and I tried everything possible to disprove it, but it was around midnight that I got a call from Maynard Eaton at the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, who told me that it was in fact true, and that our George was gone. George was the quintessential journalist. He wasn't just the black journalist, but he believed in journalism, and he taught me how to be a journalist, and that is the one thing that he underscored, is that you are always first and foremost a journalist, even when it comes to the civil rights leaders, you know, applauding them, etc. No, don't applaud them publicly. You do your job, hold them accountable, write the story, and be the quintessential journalist that you must be to hold not just black civil rights leaders accountable, but politicians across the board. He was a true teacher.
Lauren Victoria Burke, look, we ran to George covering many stories. You did as well. He was not someone who was shy about holding his tongue when he felt the black press was being dissed by black organizations or black elected officials.
Or the President of the United States. I mean, one of the things that George, of course, was trying to do is get an interview with President Obama. And I think to nobody's surprise, he wasn't able to get it because, of course, George would have gone in there and asked real questions, unlike some of the people who have interviewed the President, the endless talk show hosts and Charles Barkley and Steve Harvey and all that. And so George would have gone in and asked questions about HBCUs and poverty And George wrote an article last January 2015 on HBCUs, and I think the title that he put on the article was, "Is the President Trying to Kill HBCUs?" And so that was something, obviously, that most journalists in this country, certainly very few African-American journalists, if any, would ever write anything like that. He was not interested in being buddies with the president, or he was not interested in being in the haze of, okay, it's the first black president, so I can't say what's really going on. And in an age of celebrity journalism and opinion journalism, he was sort of the end of an era of hard-hitting, fact-based journalism, even when he was writing an opinion piece.
Spencer Overton, look, you focus a lot on politics. George was a very much a political animal. Having a strong voice speaking to those issues in the black press and setting the agenda was critically important.
Yeah, he was just critical for so many of us in our formative years here. You think about, you know, Black Enterprise in terms of business, but Emerge was like our political magazine that was with us in a critical time in life. So, you know, Joint Center is a black think tank. Emerge is the black political magazine. He shaped a whole generation of elected officials, policymakers, journalists, scholars. He certainly shaped me. You know, I was certainly a fan, and later on, I was so proud to be able to call him a friend. Obviously, you'll talk to Kimba Smith. He shaped policy. Now we're having a big sentencing debate in this country. We've already dealt a little bit with the crack cocaine disparity, but we're doing more right now. And black institutions, he was a believer in black institutions in terms of black folks trusting black institutions, and also the importance. Individuals come and go, laws change. He believed in black institutions.
Clarence Page, you were a colleague of George Curry's at the Chicago Tribune. There's no doubt, and I knew George very well, he was an unapologetic black man.
That's right, and he was, also, he and I were contemporaries, you know, both born the same year. This is quite upsetting for me. Our friendship goes back to the early 80s. And George was a very successful reporter at the Tribune. He got the scoop when Jesse Jackson decided to run for president. And it was a big headline story. And Reverend Jackson wasn't happy about that because he wanted to announce it in his own way. But George wouldn't wait. He got that scoop and ran with it. He had numerous stories like that, and he was also our New York bureau chief, which is no small job. And then he and I wound up in Washington, D.C., and both on the panel at BET, the old lead story program, which I always call the Black Man's McLaughlin Group. It was a great program, and George always had a great opportunity and took it to enlighten the rest of us to what was going on, you know, that question about HBCUs. I remember thinking at first George was being a little sensationalistic about the federal government quietly trying to kill HBCUs, but looked into it more closely, and he was right. There was a very important story going on there, and that's the way George was, and he's really going to be missed by a lot of people.
Kimba Smith, America did not know about your story until it was on the cover of Emerge magazine.
Yes, and this is actually the cover, and George Curry meant so much to me, and my family and I are taking it very hard, just because had it not been for George making the decision to put my, for lack of a better word, nobody face on the cover of his magazine to talk about an issue that most black publications in 1996 did not focus on, this issue of drugs and mandatory minimum sentencing and conspiracy drug laws. So I was very grateful when George Curry decided to highlight my case, have it be a cover story. Reginald Stewart, who wrote the article, basically had to convince him that, hey man, there's no way that I could cut this story down. So it was the first time ever where they ran like a 21-page article highlighting my story. And so, like everyone has mentioned already, George dealt with issues that sometimes people did not want to face or deal with. And so I'm very grateful He's changed my life tremendously because of this story. I know it was because Black America jumped on board to the Deltas, the Link, the National Council of Negro Women, a nation and a people that read this story, and it moved them to want to be a part of this Free Kimba Smith movement. But it wasn't about just freeing me. It was a movement about wanting to change the drug laws, and everyone hoped that my case would set a precedent. And here we are today, still fighting these same issues. So George was ahead of the game years ago, and I will forever be grateful to him and how he's inspired others to focus on stories that deal with real issues. That had it not been for this story, I would have served my full 24 and a half year sentence. Instead, I served only 6.5 years of a 24 year sentence after President Clinton granted me executive clemency. Of course, more needed to have been done, but I thank George for what he did for my life.
Clarence, I got about 30 seconds before I go to a break, but I got to ask you this here. Folks, pull this graphic up, please. Emerge was the one, when they shut down Emerge, George was heartbroken. He never got over it. He carried it with him for the last 20 plus years. He was trying to actually relaunch it as a website. George, he sent this Saturday at 2:27. And it says, I've started raising money for support EmergeNewsOnline.com. And I talked to his sister. He was there at home. He called his fiance, Ann. Said his chest was hurting. Where are you? She had gone to get food. She pulled into the garage. She said, do you want me to call the ambulance? He said, no, I want you to take me. She took him to the hospital. He said he'll be fine. She went to park the car. They wheeled him in. She came back. He went to cardiac arrest. Hour later, he died. Clarence, he literally sent this probably right before he had a heart attack. He died with his boots on.
Right. That's George. You know, and this was something, this is not a new thing. He's had heart trouble for years. Back when we were both around 50 years old, he had an operation at that time. And he afterwards was, every day he'd go out and jog for a couple of miles and really got himself in good shape. But he had an attack last year around the anniversary of the Selma March. But that was a bad sign. You know, each one weakens your heart that much more. So this time I was just so shocked and disappointed that he put up a good fight and lived a really active life and accomplished so much. And he has such a big heart, so it was ironic that it gave out on him in the end. He was a great mentor. I got to throw that in there because he's been nationally recognized for helping so many young men and women to get started in journalism and give them guidance and all. So he believed in passing it forward. So he's going to be missed by a lot of people, and so will Emerge Magazine.
Clarence Page, Kimba Smith, we appreciate it. Thanks a lot. Folks, when we come back on News One Now, we continue our tribute to George Curry, who was a friend of this show, was a personal friend of mine. And we'll talk with Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr. We'll talk with Ed Gordon, who was the host of Lead Story. Both of them knew George Curry very well right here at News One Now on TV One.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
What do you think about his appeal in the last two speeches to African-Americans saying that they should vote for him? I've said very publicly, as you know, that I don't even think he's really appealing to African-Americans. I think he's trying to make independent white voters think he's not racist. But how do you read this? And do you think, whether that's his objective or not, that some small fractions of blacks may be tempted to look at the reach out?
Well, first of all, he has not gone to a single black event except at that little black church that nobody knows of in South Carolina. He's rejected an opportunity to speak to the Urban League and the NAACP and the black journalists, NABJ. Right. And even Ronald Reagan spoke to the Urban League before the NAACP, so he won't even come there. And then he goes to Milwaukee, go out in the suburbs, and talk to most of the white audience about black Americans. So he can't be serious about this. And he just thinks we're stupid if he just thinks, oh, what you got to lose? You got a whole lot to lose, and we're not fooled by it at all. We look at his record.
Yeah, his statement was, what do you have to lose to try something new? I mean, what is that supposed to mean?
I mean, folks, that was George Curry on Friday on his weekly appearance on Reverend Al Sharpton's radio show. That was the last time George gave an interview. He appeared on Reverend Sharpton's show on a weekly basis. Joining us right now is a very good friend of his, someone who covered him, someone who ticked him off, someone who made him proud, Reverend Jesse Jackson, Sr., founder, Rainbow Push. Reverend Jackson, we are remembering our dear friend George Curry today, who passed away Saturday at the age of 69. Your most important thoughts about George?
Well, let me say first, Roland, I thank you for the call, and I'm still shocked. In a state of trauma, it seems to have happened so quickly. We talked just last week. George was smart with integrity. Grew up, of course, in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and loved Knoxville College. Became Chandler Bay Sports, fighting the same HBCU school. And that first wave of journalists to cover the national campaign, get all the tools and use them for the betterment of all of us. I'm just so grateful to George Curry for his work, for his legacy. I think most of all in the 84 campaign, when he was covering the campaign, and the white journalists began to attack the black journalists, and they were too liberal in their coverage. And he said, you're challenging our integrity. It almost came to fisticuffs. George would not bow. He had an unwavering sense of dignity and just very able role.
Reverend, one of the things that he also did, he challenged black institutions. I remember the National Urban League would often leak their State of Black America report to the New York Times or the Associated Press first before unveiling to everyone else. And George called them out saying, how dare you release that to white media, but you ignore black media?
Well, you cannot get how central to our thinking in that season of Emerge magazine. Overnight became like a flash flood of good news. Emerge. But George is a weekly column in NPA. I mean, his work stands for itself. He's a devotee, you know, of the late Vernon Jarrett, both of them went to Oxford College. So George Curry, the reason you're getting all these warm expressions today because George meant that much to all of us, Roland.
But Reverend, we certainly appreciate it. Thank you so very much. We certainly know how close you were, and thanks for joining us for our tribute to George Curry.
Love you, buddy.
When we come back, we'll talk with Ed Gorton, who was the host of BET's Lead Story, where George Curry was a panelist for 8 decades. Our tribute continues to great journalist George Curry next on News 1 Now TV 1.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
We continue our tribute to journalist George Curry, who died Saturday at the age of 69. Joining us right now from Detroit via Skype is Ed Gorton, who was the host of BET's Lead Story, where George served as a panelist along with Dwayne Wickham and Clarence Page. Ed? Certainly, you recently had breakfast with George Curry. Certainly, it's a huge loss for many of us who loved him.
Yeah, it's a tremendous loss, Roland. As you know, George was one of those voices that was unwavering for our community. And what I loved about George Curry is no matter who you were, he made a way for you. He was a trailblazer, and he wasn't afraid to share the spotlight. I remember when I first started in this business, George quickly became a mentor of mine. And in this business, it's hard to find those who are genuine and who really rally for you as your success grows. And so just thinking about the sudden loss, selfishly, it's a tremendous loss to our community with a voice that has done nothing but been outstanding and upstanding for all of us.
He had a deep, abiding love for black people.
He had a deep abiding love for black people. Yet, as you mentioned in the last segment with Reverend Jackson, he took no quarters if black people weren't doing the right thing. He called you out. He made you accountable. He wasn't afraid that he wasn't going to get the next invitation to your party if he made you upset, if he felt it justified. And oftentimes that isn't the case anymore. And so, again, this loss, I think we're all stymied by the fact that not only was it so sudden, but those of us who know realize what we've lost on that front.
We certainly appreciate Ed Gordon, you sharing your thoughts and memories about George Correa on TV One.
Thank you, Roland. Appreciate it.
When we come back, we're going to talk to our panel about Georgia's commitment to young people. Next on News One Now. Back in a moment.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Welcome back to News One Now, TV One. We continue our tribute to journalist George Curry, who passed away Saturday at the age of 69. I want to go back to our panel, Hazel Trice, Etney Long, Victoria Burke, and Spencer Overton. And Hazel, I'll start with you. George was a founder of the Urban Journalism Workshop in St. Louis. He also worked with similar workshops in New York, in Washington, D.C. He absolutely believed in paving the way and shaping the minds of the next generation of journalists.
Absolutely. When I worked with George for the 7 years that he was my editor, we were based at Howard University. And so I saw on the front lines how he loved working with students. He loved teaching. Even after he left as editor-in-chief and I became editor-in-chief, he still came to my classroom. He worked with students, teaching them how to do interviewing. And he was a no-nonsense teacher when it came to young people. He didn't let them by easy. He was very hard, and some might think even very harsh. But the lessons that he taught were amazing, and they were lasting.
Spencer Overton, 2003. I'm at the National Association of Black Journalists Convention in Dallas. It's after 2 a.m. We have one of our parties at night, and I'm standing there with George and his fiancée, Ann, and several young students come up to me, and we're talking to me, and all of a sudden, George jumps in the conversation, and we're literally having a discussion about work ethic and what these folks, these young folks need to do to prepare themselves to be journalists at 2 o'clock in the morning. George could have easily been in the bar with other journalists, could have easily been in bed, but he was there at a party, still talking to young folks at 2 o'clock in the morning about what it means to be a quality journalist.
Yeah, that was who he was. You know, last year I received an email from him, of an email he saved. I sent it to him in 2000 talking about how I was so sorry about the loss of Emerge, and he kept that email. I mean, I was just reaching out as a fan. He didn't know me at all. We've kind of gotten to know one another over the past few years, but he reached out to me. I mean, he was really into young people and development, and again, there are just dozens and dozens of people who are right now in their 40s, their 50s, they're elected officials, they are journalists, they're scholars and professors at universities who are basically shaped by him in terms of work commitment, in terms of integrity, in terms of commitment to black people. And so, you know, his legacy is really significant in terms of all of the young people he touched.
About 30 seconds before I go to break, Lauren, Victoria Burke, you heard Spencer talk about that email. One of the last letters that Senator Ted Kennedy ever wrote before he died was to George Curry.
That makes sense. You know, George, I was just during the break looking at some of the emails that have come in. Obviously, George had his, you know, he had his weekly email of columns. And the piece where George was so really concerned about black media ownership was huge. And like Hazel was saying, he was a really tough advisor, a no-nonsense person when it came to giving advice. And there's no, like, sugarcoating anything, which I really appreciated. It's very direct. He didn't waste any time mincing words. So obviously, George will be greatly missed.
Many folks may be wondering why, for me, I got emotional here. And that is because yesterday, I called George's sister. First of all, I was made aware of George's passing around 9 p.m. Saturday night. We did, like Hazel said, many of us tried to make calls confirming it, did not want to believe it. But yet last night I was reached out on Twitter by a church member of his sister. They hit me up and they said his sister and his mother wanted to speak to me. His sister, Sue, got on the phone and she said, "I just need to hear your voice." She started crying. And I was wondering why she was crying, and she said, because George talked about you so much, it was as if you were a brother. He respected you so much and respected him so much. And some people may wonder, okay, well, why would you spend this much time on the journalist? Because here's the reality. ABC, NBC, and CBS, they probably will spend lots of time when one of their journalists passes. For us, George was one of ours. Mm-hmm. George was in our family. George covered us. George appeared on this show. He brought us his wisdom, his intellect. George had a ridiculous sense of humor. But here's the other thing that's important. His fiance Ann called me yesterday. And George had a love-hate relationship with his home state of Alabama. He vowed never to go back to Alabama. George Curry said he grew up with the racism of Alabama and despised what took place. But Ann told me that they often talked about him dying. And he said, when I die, you must return me back to Tuscaloosa, Alabama. The family right now is working to get his body there. He said he must get there quickly. His funeral will be held in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. A native of Alabama, as son returns home. So many of us will miss him. So many of us appreciate his hard work. We also thank him for his friendship. And I do as well. Folks, we always make sure here at TV One, we celebrate those of ours who pass away their proper home going. And that's why we dedicated the last several segments to the great George Curry. We'll see you tomorrow.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.